No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Kathleen Gomez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the discussion by calling in at 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Or Skype us at BBS Radio 1. Tonight, we're going to continue our conversation on the violence that has erupted across the country over the police shootings in Missouri, New York, and California, and on the decision by the grand jury in two of those cases not to indict. We're going to continue to talk about how people are reacting to these incidents and the continuing unrest that seems to be spreading nationwide. So if you have a question or a comment, please let us hear from you. Before we start, let me introduce my co-host, Kathleen Gomez, who is back from her long road trip and is ready to correct me and set me and America straight on the issues that matter. Hi, Kathleen. Are you rested and ready to talk to the nation?
Yes, I'm rested. I'm back in Arizona where it was 75 degrees today. I mean, I tell you, there's something about warm weather in December. It makes everyone very lazy. Like, everyone's like in flip-flops and their pajamas walking around. It's the strangest thing, you know, or real short shorts and tank tops, and it's still this, I don't know, it's a strange thing. But yes, I'm rested and content and ready to go.
Well, I think first let me just say that I'm happy to be in the cold weather because my short shorts and tank top wearing days are over. Nobody wants to see that anymore. Before I start, I want to mention today, today is a day that President Roosevelt said would live in infamy. It's the 73rd anniversary of the bombing of Pearl Harbor, which marked our entry into the Second World War, a war that really did save the world. I mean, I know we've got a lot of conflicts going on today, and there's a lot of questions on whether we should be here or whether we should be there. But I think history has pretty much written the story that the Second World War was something that changed the course of history for the whole world, and our involvement in it changed it in a positive way. So if you know a veteran, thank them. Especially if you know a veteran from the Second World War. Now, you'd have to be in your 90s at least to be a veteran of the Second World War, so there aren't many of them left. So if you see one of them, thank them for saving the world. I also want to do a shout-out to my friend Rick Railing. I always remember his birthday because it's on Pearl Harbor Day. Happy birthday, Rick. He's my oldest friend. We met on my 12th birthday. My mother forced me to invite him to my 12th birthday party, and we've been friends every year ever since. This year, in August, we will have been friends for 50 years. So happy birthday, Rick. Hope you're having a good day. I know he went to the Redskins game today. Not a good day. The Redskins got trounced again. We were going to talk about immigration today because it seemed to be unfolding in Congress. Nothing really new has happened about it, but also we've decided to change it up a little bit because of all this stuff that's been going on over the last week. I mean, we had a show last week where we talked to Mike from Ferguson, who, you know, was a great show. He gave us great insights to what's going on there. But look what's happened since then.
I know. You know, it's interesting because on Friday night, you know, I guess due to the Gardner case, too, and them not indicting, there was a peaceful protest downtown in Old Tucson, okay? And they were all, I guess, blocking traffic, and they didn't have a permit. But it was peaceful protesting. But then at one point, all of a sudden, there was like 30 police. And they kind of came down in a pack, you know, and they were just going and they were starting to push people. I mean, I was kind of surprised by it. I mean, I understand everyone got on the sidewalk. They were on the sidewalk and then they started pushing them, you know, like real aggressively. And I was like, okay, they're chanting and they're holding up signs. But there's like, you know, they're not really doing anything that would be violent or would necessitate them to have such a aggressive action to them. You know what I mean? So It was interesting that even in Tucson, which, you know, I kind of find as a very low key area, you know, that the reaction by the police was very, I think, over the top here too. I don't know if they've been giving, you know, they're fearful or they feel like they have to show more force than is necessary. But it definitely, you could see it just in hearing the police in Tucson, a very aggressive attitude, much more than was really needed. If they could have been more diplomatic, I think it would have cut it, you know, cut the kind of protesters. They would have dispersed earlier, but to have the police come like in this packs and just kind of, you know, push against the protesters on the sidewalk, it was kind of disturbing to see. And it seems that that's what's happening across the nation.
Well, you know, one thing, and I think this would be a great, I'm going to throw this out there, and I hope that somebody takes me up on it. But, you know, as you know, I was involved in a protest where I was arrested by the Capitol Hill police, the one and only time I've ever been arrested. And the Capitol Hill Police have a division, you know, a part of their police department that does nothing but arrest protesters. That's all they do. Now, of course, they have a lot of protesters at the Capitol, so it makes sense for them to have one group of officers who does nothing but arrest people. But I've never seen, you know, I mean, there was some violence that broke out over a woman who tried to run through the gates of the White House. But in general, with all the protests they have up there, things go pretty smoothly. Maybe they should be out there training other police departments how to do it, because they know how to do it. Let me tell you.
Oh, I know. And, you know, it was last year, you know, when I think U of A won the basketball tournament, I think it was. And there was a video that went viral of a police officer actually pushing a young student, a girl who was just crossing the street, pushed her very violently, and she fell over this concrete bench and hit her head. I mean, it was such an overreaction. The guy was all in, like, you know, gear and the shield and the riot thing, and then here's this little girl, you know, with her in flip-flops and shorts and a tank top drinking, I don't know what it was, like, you know, one of those tea things, and boom, man, just hit her. I mean, she's ended up going to sue the city police, and also the police officer, I think, got into a lot of trouble because it was just such a over-the-top reaction, and I think you're right. They definitely need training on how to deal with the public and peaceful protesters and how to try to, instead of instigate more of this craziness, like you would see in Soviet Union, you know, how the police in Soviet Union just come and they just run over you. And that's kind of what I saw in Tucson. It's just crazy. I don't know what's going on with them, but they definitely need to get some retraining and try to learn skills to help disperse, you know, the protesters after they've finished protesting. It's crazy.
Yeah, it really is. And you know, especially since this is a right of our democracy, you know, we have the right in our democracy to assemble peacefully and protest. This is not something that should be so out of the ordinary. It's something we actually should do more of, I think. But in order to make that work, in terms of both sides, the you know, public safety and giving us our right to protest and actualize the rights given us under the Constitution. I think, yeah, we need to train these people, and we need to understand who we're dealing with on both sides. You know, policemen go out there and walk around the streets and have to deal with terrible things all the time. So when they overreact, I think we need to, you know, obviously we can't tolerate that kind of behavior, but we need to understand it, and we need to do things to head it off at the pass, more or less. And you know, I think we also, and I got to tell you, the Washington Post ran an article, editorial today on this, and I think this is absolutely has to be done too, is we need special prosecutors to prosecute these cases. Yeah, we can't, you know, you can't have the local authorities do it because they rely on the police. You can't have a district attorney who relies on the police all the time for expert testimony and testimony and as witnesses to crimes, and they have to testify and arrest and all this. They're basically on the same team most of the time. Then you can't turn around and ask these people to prosecute people that are actually on their team. I think we need independent counselors to do this stuff, and I think you'd come out with a different result, because people are pissed, man. They're pissed. Yeah. When's the last time we've seen this activity over something? It's been a while.
It's been a long, maybe Vietnam War, I think, or maybe it was, you know, the whole thing when we were looking at a depression when you know, Wall Street, you know, remember it was that whole Wall Street, but nothing that's kind of, I think, scared people as much as what's going on, you know, with the police. And you know, again, it's kind of like a double-edged sword. I mean, you need the police. It's a terrible, tough job that they have to deal with.
It is a terrible, tough job.
And with now with everyone having guns, you know, owning guns and dealing with all the crazy stuff that they have to deal with, you know, can mentally put you in a state. But I think it's also, you know, they got a tough job. And at the same time, I'll never forget a friend of mine in a small town where I was in Douglas was had a problem with her ex-husband. And so she called the police, and he had come in, and there was some interesting circumstances. But anyway, the reaction of the police was, well, like, you know, it's your fault. It was a woman's fault. And obviously, this was brand new, you know, young guys that got on the police force, hadn't had any training, you know, just kind of got in a uniform with a gun. And we can't do that. We have to have real good training on dealing with the public. I mean, you know, not only when you're dealing with the criminals, but just when you're dealing with the people who are watching you. I mean, I think there needs to be more of that. And I think they learned that after Vietnam War and the 64 and the riots, that the police were getting more training on how to, instead of escalating the situation, finding skills in which to de-escalate it. And they just don't seem to be doing that now.
Well, you know what? It's funny that you bring that up, because I remember a really important protest that they had at the Pentagon. And they had had this was during the Vietnam War, and they had several altercations in Lafayette Square across from the White House and other places. So this was a big, big war protest that they were going to have at the Pentagon, and the Pentagon was getting ready for it, and they surrounded the entire building with troops. And if you've ever been to Washington and you've ever seen the Pentagon is the world's largest office building. I mean, larger than the Twin Towers in New York City. And the amazing thing about that is that it's only about, I don't know, 8 or 10 stories high. It's not a very high building, but it's just gigantic. You know, it's like covers more area than a football stadium would cover. So they surrounded it, but they only used troops that had combat experience. They didn't use any. We had the terrible incident at Kent State where where the National Guard opened fire on those students, and one of the things they said was, well, they were scared and they were inexperienced, and so they used nobody but combat troops that had been in combat and knew what it was like to be in a tense situation, and you know, nothing happened. It was a peaceful protest. Nothing got out of hand. So I think there's a lot to be said for that. And when you talk about the Wall Street stuff, you know, they were so much different. I think that's the scary thing, too. You know, that these guys for the Occupy, we had an Occupy DC here, and there was certainly a big one in New York and one in Chicago. I think there was one in L.A. But these people came out, and they were really peaceful.
Yeah.
You know, there were very few incidents. And even the District of Columbia police, who are more used to this, probably way more used to it than like the Tucson police, were sued last year, and the protesters won over a thing that happened at the World Bank, where they arrested a lot of protesters, and the jury decided to use too much force. So even when you have the training, it's not easy. But yeah, but that's an absolute minimum thing you have to do, I think. You know, I also heard it said this week that in the case of Ferguson, for example, and I wish we had Mike on, we could ask him how he felt about this because he's a great guest. I also heard somebody say that, you know, they had a lawyer on that said, look, these guys are well prepared. They're well prepared by their union, the police. They know how to testify, and they know how to frame things in such a way that the jury, for a jury trial, in front of a grand jury, they kind of couch things in terms of what would you have done in this situation. And they get a lot of sympathy from juries for that. You know, it's like when there's a drunk driving case. If you have the option to have a jury trial, you know, they say you should opt for a jury trial, right? Because who hasn't had one too many drinks and gotten behind the wheel of a car? And that's the whole idea, is that you get the jury to empathize with you, and you say, look, you know, I've done the same thing this guy's done. I just didn't get caught, or I didn't hit somebody, or I didn't cause a terrible accident. I got lucky. And I think that they try to do that in these cases too, that they say, look, both of these guys, and this is the crux of the issue for me, both of these guys were very big African-American guys. And when I say both of these guys, I mean Michael Brown and Eric Gardner. They were both large African-American guys. And the cops, you know, I think were afraid. And I think that that doesn't justify their behavior. In the Gardner case, for example, the guy was being very peaceful, and they overwhelmed him. I mean, there was no excuse for that kind of behavior. But I think when they put it up before a jury, the jury's probably saying to himself, well, hell yeah, I'd be scared of that guy too. And that's the wrong way to couch the whole argument. You know, these guys are professionals. This is what they're supposed to do. They should know how to handle it, you know?
Right, right. It's interesting. I don't know if you heard that background, but, you know, recently in Phoenix, I guess 2 days ago, another incident happened where, you know, I don't know all the facts yet. I think they're still investigating, but supposedly a policeman, you know, a guy was driving, delivering fast food to his 4 kids. And I guess, I don't know, maybe it doesn't say why the police were in the neighborhood. I guess they yelled at him and told him to, you know, put up his hands. I can't figure it out, but I gather that he was out of his car and going into his apartment, put his hands into his pocket, and they shot him. And what he did have was a bottle of oxycodone. And I don't know if they felt he was dealing drugs or what, but why do they have to shoot him to kill? I mean, aren't they trained to shoot at the legs or you know, maim them but not kill them?
I know
that is a big issue going on in Phoenix. And when you look at the video of what happened in New York, you know, the guy you can see is big. I have read somewhere, and I'm not sure that I'm correct, that he was somewhat, you know, mentally challenged, but I'm not sure that's true. I thought I read it. But anyway, if you look at him, you see that he's got his hands up, but he's asking them not to touch him. Like, he's just kind of like saying, you know, don't, but he's not being aggressive at all. He's just kind of trying to stop, you know, them from going nuts, and they just keep on going crazy, and then 5 guys are on top of him, and you see that guy choking him from the back, and they're trying to bring him down. I mean, that's the other thing. I guess they wanted him to go on the floor. But, you know, when you're big and heavy, it's very difficult to go to the floor. It's not, if you're a tall person, and he was very large and overweight, it's very difficult to go down to your knees and get on the floor.
And he was 47 years old. Not that that's old, but it's also not a kid either, you know. And you know what I find strange, really, really strange about the whole incident? If you look at the tape, and you know, if you remember the movie that Spike Lee did called Do the Right Thing, it's very similar to the incident in Do the Right Thing, right? The guy was thrown out of the place from playing his radio too loud. The cops came; they were very aggressive. He was a very big man, Radio Raheem, remember? And they choked him out. And I mean, it was just. It was the same kind of scene, which and the reason I mention this is because it's kind of the stereotypical thing that I think African Americans have to deal with, and this is one of the reasons they're so outraged. You know, I think they're saying to themselves in a lot of places, this isn't atypical. This isn't, you know, something that happens every once in a while. It happens all the damn time. Yeah. And we're tired of it. And I think that's what we're seeing. We're seeing protests here in Washington. I mean, in Tucson. When was the last time you guys in Tucson protested a national issue that didn't directly affect the people of Tucson, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's what's happening is this is affecting people in every major city in America. Look, if you're out there and you're a cop or you're a protester and you have an opinion on this, call us. Call in because we'd love to hear what you have to say. Again, our number is 888-627-6008. Or you can Skype us if you don't want to be on the radio on BBS, that's Boy Boy Sam, Radio 1, because we'd love to hear from you. I'd love to know what's going on. In the minds of these people, especially the cops. I mean, it's not an easy job.
We've already said that. And I do realize too that when I talk to, you know, my poor son, I use him as like an example. But when I talk to him and listen to his friends and how the feeling is, and these are upper class kids. They're not kids that are, you know, dealing with economic issues. There is such a dislike and distrust of the police. And I try to tell him, you know, I said, well, you know, we need law and order, but it's just such a dislike of the police that I find it interesting. And especially after that, one girl was just knocked off her feet and it was the worst thing I had seen in a long time for an officer to do to a young woman. You know, it's been very, very tense on U of A campuses. So, and then I think, you know, it overall, we've got something going on in our country from, you know, you heard about the rape case, you know, in Rolling Stone that got a lot of fraternities and U of A in trouble. And now they're saying, well, maybe that story isn't correct. And this is my other issue. The press has a lot to do with instigating what's going on, because I still think that there's so much that they don't print and to slant it to get the public to react a certain way. And where at one point you could expect the police to check out all their sources and make sure that they're presenting the facts, they don't do that. We know that. We saw that in Washington with the election. They don't even bother to. They just figure, oh, well, we'll pick three or four people that we think may win and we'll interview those and endorse one out of those. They don't give that facts and they don't do their research. So the fact that this article got in the Rolling Stone about the rape, and now, you know, I was in college and that was the same thing that was happening. You know, you go to parties and they would say, you know, be smart, cover your drink, open your own drink, never set it down. And, you know, you go into the situation with your eyes wide open. Just like in the Central Park case, you know, in theory, yes, it would be nirvana to be able to run in Central Park back in those days at 2 o'clock in the morning. But that's not realistic. And it's not realistic to go to a fraternity party where guys are going to be guys, young men are young men, and they're going to be drinking. And, you know, you're going to have trouble. So everyone's got to go in with open eyes instead of like, well, I mean, I just don't understand young women. they should know better, and I don't understand the men either for doing this, because they're only going to get themselves in deep trouble. But there again, the press is questioned whether or not the story, all the facts were checked, and whether or not it's the truth. So, you know, when we were looking at the Michael Brown case, we were hearing so many different stories, and I still talk to people who believe that Michael Brown had reached in and tried to grab the gun. And as we were talking last week with Michael Miller, he was saying, you know, that would be really, really difficult to do.
Right.
But the press has put that out, and then some press has put that it didn't happen. So it's a matter of, like, who the heck do you believe?
Well, you know, and we've talked about this many times before, but also now the 24-hour news cycle that we have and the 50 different types of news that you can get. I mean, your news from the internet. I mean, I don't know how many channels you get on your cable. You're in Arizona, so you probably only get one or two.
Because you get people, 500
you still,
if
you still, you people out there, who knows?
Sending smoke signals.
Yeah, but you know, right? You get 500 channels, and then you don't even need to get your news from that. You can get your news from the internet on your phone. You don't, you know, so there's like all this pressure for these guys to write something new and something that's going to grab the headlines and something. So I think they go off half-cocked a lot of times.
And we talked about this too, that so much, if you're on Twitter, I mean, to me, Twitter has become like an unbelievable news source. You know, you get the Twitter account for your New York Times or Washington Post or Huffington Post or whatever. And then you start seeing journalists having their own Twitter, and it becomes more about them than it comes about the news, and they become almost this celebrity type of thing, and that's not serving us well. These guys need to report the facts and let us decide instead of trying, you know, to become celebrity journalists, get following, see how much following you. And then, you know, the stuff that I see isn't even newsworthy. It's like whether one fell down on the bike and another one is eating here at a restaurant. But they've got, you know, and they tweet this out. It's just crazy. We are in such a crazy time that I think 150 years from now, when they look back, they're going to see that this decade with the social media and all this technological advances are going to really change who we are and what we do.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. And you know, we've seen those changes in our own lifetime in different, you know, things like gender roles and things that changed dramatically when we were young. And now this is the big change for America today is all this instant news. And yeah, I mean, I find out things when you talk about Twitter. I know that I've found out things where people have called me on the phone and said, look, this just happened and I think you should know it, you know, like personal things in my family and other things. And then I've called my daughter in Chicago and she's told me somebody already tweeted me about it.
Yeah.
One of my cousins already tweeted me about it. You know, my nephew got engaged. I call, your cousin got engaged. I know. We've been talking about it on the internet for the last 20 minutes. It just happened.
Exactly.
You know, but yeah, they're up on the latest thing.
Right. It's just crazy. So we're going to take a break, I gather, and you've chosen the song.
Yeah, and I just want to point something out to you. When you use your son as a guinea pig, because he's my godson and I know him very well. First of all, let me tell you, if you're arrested, he will not protest.
I guess you mean because if I get arrested, I'll definitely not.
Oh, if you get arrested, right. No, he's not going to protest. In fact, I'm not even sure he put up the bail unless you had collateral.
Exactly.
Maybe if you had some collateral, he might lend you the money at prime plus one.
Because, you know, he already thinks I'm a hippie from the, you know, like that crazy time in the 60s when I, you know, he says, Mama, you know, it's probably just all those, you know, that psychedelic hippie thing that you grew up in. That's what I'm going to blame all your problems. And, you know, they really do believe that, too. They don't have,
that's,
I mean.
It is, though.
Why?
Because you were a hippie. See, he's right. That was it. You know,
that was it. That
before was... we take the break, I'll tell you that you know, we lost a guy in Washington, as you well know. We lost Marion Barry, and I went to his funeral yesterday. And Marion Barry's a great. We'll talk about him after the break a little bit. He's a great case study because he was such a human being. You know what I mean? He did some really, really great things in his life. We all know that he had lots of personal problems,
addiction,
and you know, had things to come and did some things that weren't very good. But he's a great case study because he just shows you, you know, everybody's a mix of good and bad, and he certainly did a lot of good things. But his wife got up to eulogize him, and maybe the most amazing thing about Marion Barry is that he was one of 10 children, and his father was a sharecropper in Itzabina, Mississippi. Itabina, Mississippi, a little tiny town that nobody's ever heard of, and his father was a sharecropper, and he grew up to be the mayor of the most powerful city in the world. That in itself was amazing. But his wife used to said yesterday, he was who he was. So they would go on some diplomatic mission to Europe or something, and she'd look over and he'd have like one of those recyclable trash bags from the grocery store with his stuff in it. And she would say to him, Marion, you've got a briefcase at home with, you know, it's a beautiful leather briefcase that I bought you that's embossed in gold and blah, why are you carrying this? And he goes, it doesn't matter. And she would say, it does matter. And she said she called that his being Mississippi. So Diego's right. You're being a hippie, but that's okay. That's why we love you.
Yeah, I know that.
And on that note, let us take a break. We've got a message for you from the police. This is something that we should all take to heart. So listen to this advice and consider it carefully. We'll be back in a few minutes. Thanks. And we're back, and I hope you listen carefully, America, because that's what we need to do. We need to rehumanize ourselves, and that's the police and the protesters and everybody involved. We really need to get back to the essence of being one people committed to each other, I think. We need more yoga, less guns, more yoga.
More yoga. You know, remember, I mean, we kind of grew up in the times of some real, like, Kent State and all the, you know, anti-war protesters. And you know, then we came to some kind of healing, you know, like in the late 70s and 80s. And now it just seems so strange with a African-American president and, you know, Mexican, Cuban, Latino senators and stuff. It's just kind of shocking to think that we haven't been able to you know, get rid of the race issue per se. And I don't know if it's because we've become polarized in our politics where we just have all right and left wingers and nobody in the middle that can kind of guide us to some kind of moderation in both ends. And I think that probably is part of the most destructive part in our society right now is this polarization of our political thinking, which I always say politics is in everything you do.
Yep. You and Aristotle. Aristotle also said that. He said anything that involves two people involves politics. And you know that. I mean, you know that as a mother. I mean, when that baby is a baby, it's only a few days old, he starts to manipulate you.
Oh, yes.
I mean, yeah, and they're uh-oh, I should have opened that can of worms.
I know, a bunch of things.
Not with somebody that's got teenagers. Yeah, but yeah, it's true. But, you know, one thing that has substantially changed from when you and I were in college was that when we were in college, there were jobs for everybody.
Right.
You know, we assumed we were going to get a job. We didn't know a job we were going to get. In fact, you and I will have to talk about this off the air, but on Wednesday, I'm going to go see all our old friends at the Democratic National Committee, right? They're going to dedicate a floor to our former boss, Chuck Manette. But, you know, we had jobs. We complained about them. They paid us like, I don't know, like $1 an hour or something to work our asses off. It sounded like a good salary until you found out you had to work 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. But we all had jobs. And we weren't there wasn't the same kind of competition that there is in the world now. And I think in our world, in America, that the struggle has brought out some of these things that are not good in our society.
And you know, it's awful too, because I see, you know, in a lot of things that they've gone to computers, you know, like machines doing jobs, you know, which lets a lot of people off. And, you know, whether it's the bank teller, you know, is going to be less and less of a reality to, you know, even in the grocery stores, look at how you can now, you know, do your own groceries in the checkout. And those are more now getting to have more stations for that than there are actually live people, you know, doing your groceries, except for people like you who just find it impossible. You just can't do it. You need that checkout person, because I've seen you try to check out your groceries, and it's not a pretty scene.
I know. I'm probably paying more than I should, because I'm doing some stuff twice. But, you know, the machines don't like me. I got to be honest with you. I've always had a problem with them. But, yeah, you know, sometimes we don't think about those consequences. You know, you look at a guy like me who started working full time pretty much when I was 14 years old. But there's not a lot of jobs for 14-year-olds. But when I was a 14-year-old boy, you could walk into about any gas station and get a job pumping gas. And that's what I did. I pumped gas. And I used to think, this was like one of my first real jobs, and I used to think to myself, wow, it would be so great to make $2 an hour, because I made $1.35 an hour. And I'd be like, it'd be so great to make $2 an hour, and then I wouldn't have to pump my own, you know, I wouldn't have to pump gas anymore. And of course, now I still pump gas. We all pump gas. Mm-hmm. But, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of jobs were lost soon as these guys figured out that you could pump your own gas.
Right. And remember, you would come and they'd do your windows and they check your those days, check your oil, check your fluids and your tire pressure. And they
were 28 cents a gallon.
Yes.
And if you got 8 gallons, so what's that, like $2 worth of gas, a little more than $2 worth of gas, you got a free glass.
Yes, and those things are so collectible nowadays. I remember the S&H stamps. Oh, heck yes. And the S&H stamps and stuff. And, you know, each state had their own thing. Like, in Arizona, they had this thing where, you know, you got these glass. They were Blakely, and it's like different pictures of different cactuses. And then there was a picture with a certain, like the, you know, the tall glasses. Those things now go for $250, $300. You can hardly find them. And it's like, and then remember the S&H stamps? You would fill it up and you go in and be able to buy like a, you know, a saucepan or dishes to a dish set that was pretty nice. And all. Remember they had a store that was just full of stuff that you could get through these stamps, you know?
Yeah. I remember we never could collect enough stamps to get anything more than like a badminton set. Or a croquet set. I think we had a croquet set. What happened to croquet? We need to bring back croquet.
And badminton.
Professional croquet, you know.
That's right.
We need to bring it back. It used to be, you know, a great family sport.
And you know, the other thing that has gotten to me too is how much of our outsourcing we do to India. Like, you know, my baggage didn't come through when I was coming from DC to Kansas, so I had to, you know, try to find where my luggage was. And all I could do was get India. And I kept on saying, you don't understand. I'm in Kansas City and this airport is far away and I can't get, you know, and they're like, oh yes, well, you know, we will call you 2 days. I'm like, you don't, I get me someone in America. And I kept on hanging up and recalling and recalling. I could never get anyone in the United States. And finally went to the website of the airport and managed to track a number down for the luggage. But these guys were just clueless. And I remember one time my purse was stolen in New York, and I was calling to tell them about canceling my credit cards, and it was like they couldn't understand what I meant because they don't live in the United States, so they couldn't understand what it, you know, they were arguing me about, like, I hadn't called them in time. I said my wallet was just stolen and I'm trying to call, you know, I mean, it's just very difficult to communicate with them when we have so much of that that's been outsourced to India. In fact, I know that Sprint in Kansas City has a huge Indian population because they bring these guys from India for 2 years, right? Like on a visa. Yes. And then that's how they rotate it. So they don't have to, I mean, the Indians are feeling very happy to live in all this space and it's, you know, really nice apartment complex and all that. But then they send it back so they don't have to pay, you know, retirement and workmen, I'm sure some type of workman's comp, but they don't have to pay the expenses they would pay if they hired American workers. And that's right. The other problem that it impacts our kids. Right. Is there's just less and less that people are relying on the human counterpart, the human interface. I mean, you know, and it's terrible. And we're really doing the United States a disservice. I mean, I just don't see how we can... you know, we have to protect our own people first, and then we can protect everybody else. You know,
And you know what? Getting back to what we were originally talking about, this can be part of the problem too, is that we don't connect anymore. I mean, we used to have, they probably can't have this so much out where you are, but, you know, when I was a kid, I grew up in North New Jersey. You lived in New York City for so many years. I lived in here in Washington, in places like St. Louis and New York, where this stuff is going on. We used to have beat policemen who knew the people that they were dealing with. They knew the thing, what was going on in the neighborhood. And this has become a big thing in Washington now. We call it community policing. But we need more of that because people have lost their ability to interact. I worry about my kids all the time because they can go through a whole day. You know, when they're not in school and they have to interact with their teachers and other students, they can go a whole day without ever interacting with a human being. I mean, they can get their, you know, money out of a bank machine and you know, talk to people over the computer. They don't call. Kids don't call. What is up with that? You know, my kids never call me. They text me.
I know.
It's like...
It's crazy. Well, it's a commitment, you know, when you have to talk to somebody on the phone.
Right.
But you're absolutely right. I remember, you know, we grew up when we were out on the streets riding our bikes, playing four, you know, maybe having little mini gang fights with our, you know, the kids we didn't like or whatever it may be. But we were interacting with each other. And, you know, I remember Diego was, you know, interacting by sitting in the living room playing games with people in Germany and his friends three blocks down the street.
Right.
You know, and they can do it through the internet and that, but put them in a situation where they got to go up to somebody, introduce themselves, and start a conversation, they're losing that skill.
Right. Well, first, I don't want to regress too much here, but I would like to focus for a second. What do you mean having fights with gags? Was that before you became a hippie?
Yeah, that was when we would get gored.
You were in a gang before you became a hippie, and then...
We had our little desert gangs and stuff, and
I think my whole childhood between the ages of 7 and 12 was consumed with either playing a sport or having a toy gun in my hand, fighting with neighborhood kids, you know, playing army and going, I shot you. No, you didn't shoot me. Yes, I did. Oh, it was just a wound. Oh, I shot you in the head. Oh, it bounced on my head. And, yeah.
Exactly.
You know, we spent a lot of time doing that. But it was character building, and it was, and you were building relationships with people, and you were, you know, it wasn't only a good time, but you learned a lot of skills in doing it and how to deal with people and how to maneuver and
negotiating with, you know, the kids that you supposedly shot, you know, to get some kind of agreement.
My kids hate that stuff. They hate it. If they have a problem that they have to deal with and you say, oh, take that back to the store or go talk to the lady about it, or you need to call somebody or what, they hate that.
Yeah.
They want to be able to deal with it over the internet. They also use it very strategically. Ma, dad, I'm going over to Susie's house. Well, they know it's going to be a half an hour before you get the message. They text it to you. They'll already be at Susie's house. Hopefully that's where they're going. Maybe they're not going to Susie's house. But, you know, they also are very strategic about the way they use it. So, yeah, I think we need to interact more.
You love to say that you hate to regress, but I'd like to ask you, what was kind of the defining thing? I know that the service was really long for Mary and Barry. And for people who didn't live in Washington, you know, I think outside of D.C. they might have had a bad impression of Mary and Barry, but he did do so much for the people of D.C. And he laid in state for like a week, right, or something?
Actually 24 hours at City Hall. But they, because of the Thanksgiving holiday, he died just before Thanksgiving. They put everything off until after Thanksgiving. So everything took like a week longer. But, you know, you have to – as I said earlier, he went from being one of 10 children of a sharecropper to the head of the mayor of the most powerful city in the world. But he also did other things that I didn't know about that I just found out about yesterday at his service, which were amazing. First of all, he was an Eagle Scout.
You may think that's
not that big a deal, but I was a Boy Scout. I can tell you it's a big deal. And to do it as a black kid in Mississippi in the 1940s, because that's when he was born in 1936, to do it in the 1940s, that was an amazing thing, amazing feat in itself. Then he grew up to be – he was working on a PhD in chemistry. He actually went to college in Kansas. I can't remember the name of the school. Kansas, yeah.
Wow.
But he was working on his PhD in chemistry. When he dropped out to he was asked to give a speech to introduce Dr. King when Dr. King came to speak at his college. And so he did that. He got involved in the civil rights movement, came to Washington, and became the first leader of SNCC. The first national leader of SNCC. And for anybody that knows about the civil rights movement, SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, was one of the essential actors in the civil rights movement of the 60s. They did sit-ins and boycotts and protests, and they were there every step of the way. And many of the people that came out of SNCC went on to be national leaders, and Marion Barry was one of them. But locally, some of the things he did, which were just amazing to me, is he started the National Capital Area Food Bank, which gives free meals and uses excess food and coordinates the distribution of food to low-income people in the District of Columbia. And as of yesterday, they had served over 1 billion, with a B, over 1 billion meals in the 20-some years that they've been around. So he did that. He started a summer job program, which gave 100,000 jobs to underprivileged youth in the District of Columbia. 100,000 jobs through a single summer jobs program. And they asked people in the audience. Now, they had at this memorial service, they had, I don't know, I would guess at least 5,000 people. And they asked people in the audience if they had gotten their first job through the Marion Barry Summer Jobs Program to raise their hand, and hundreds of people raised their hand. I mean, he gave so many jobs to people in the district, and he opened up the district government to African Americans. When he took office, the year he took office as mayor, he was elected four times as mayor, by the way. In the time he took office, 2% of all D.C. government contracts went to minority contractors. When he left office as mayor, when he was unfortunately sent to jail, 50% of all D.C. government contracts went to minority contractors. So he opened up the door for African Americans in a city that was run by Southern white people. A lot of people don't know this. I mean, sometimes we refer to D.C. as a Southern city, but it was more than that. There was a committee of Congress that controlled the city. This was before we had home rule. Home rule we've had for 40 years. But 40 years ago, a group of Southern Democrats ruled the District of Columbia, and they were not kind to African Americans, as we all remember. So he changed all that, and he also was elected to the first city council that we ever had during home rule.
And home rule, explain that to people, because it's hard to believe that until home rule, people who lived in D.C. could not vote for anybody, not even president.
Right. Nobody. Nope. They got to vote for president because of a constitutional amendment, but they couldn't pass any local laws. The whole city was run by a committee of Congress. And then we got a mayor and a city council so that we could be like everybody else, theoretically. And we could, write our own laws, pass our own laws, implement our own budget. The only problem is that Congress still has control in the sense that they get to approve everything.
Right.
So, and we're feeling... we'll report more and more on how this feels, because they've just taken my delegation, the congressional delegation, locally, and they're subjecting us to the same thing. Now everything we do has to be approved by the mayor.
By the city council? Oh, my gosh. That's another whole thing. We're going to have to get really into this. You know, I think that one thing I know you said to me that I found interesting was that there was definitely an air, and a lot of the speakers talk about statehood, that they had to become a state. And yet you seem to say the city council really wasn't clapping every time there was a statehood, right? Mention of statehood.
Well, it's funny because they would talk about the many things that Barry had done. He had done the job programs. They would clap. He had done the food bank. They would clap. And then they would say, and he was instrumental in our fight for statehood, which he was. He started the modern statehood movement in the District of Columbia. And nobody on the city council clapped. Everybody else, other people in the auditorium clapped. But people on the city council were, so I think they showed their true colors there for a second. They really don't want, but that's all right, because Kathleen Gomez and I are going to make it happen anyway.
We're going to go outside the box. Even if they don't want it, we're going to make it happen.
We're going to make it happen. Right. That's it's right. Just like eating your broccoli. Your mother made you do it. It was good for you. Maybe you didn't like it, but it was happening. And we're here to go on notice to tell the people of America that statehood's going to happen. And we're going to make it happen. Even if you don't like it.
Well, we're 60 seconds from closing out. I mean, it's amazing how quickly time goes by when you have something interesting to say, and it really is hats off to Marion Barry. He was quite a figure and had done some incredible things and was really, like you said, always for statehood. And that's something that when people, it's always amazing when people go to funerals, he was such a great man, but then you think, then why did you fight him on some of the great issues that he was, known for, like statehood? Why didn't you?
Well, and what? I think it shows that we're all a mix of good and bad. Yeah. Kathleen, you've pointed that out yourself. You were a gang member before you were a hippie.
That's
you're
right.
A gang member, then you became a hippie.
And the next show, we'll talk about everything that's kind of bad and the good with you, too. That's a long list that I found out.
Just take more than one show. The good won't. The good would do that in the last 30 seconds, but the bad's going to take a while. All right, America, thanks for listening to us. As always, Kathleen, you have the last word.
Oh my gosh, I really can't believe it when you say that. It always shocks me. I just want to thank everyone. Let's be kind to one another. Try always to be peaceful, but let's don't give up. Let's fight for change. We can do it. Get involved in every aspect of your life and politics.
We'll see you next week, America.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.